I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. It's a new year, and 2013 starts with capturing the essence of Orlando in sculpture. That's the goal of a group of local leaders and private investors who want to install large, iconic sculptures in the city's downtown. I'll talk with Orlando Mayor Buddy Dyer and others involved in the effort to boost the city's cultural identity. Plus, when a new year comes, people want to look ahead. But we'll look to the heavens and talk with a NASA composer who gets his inspiration from the red planet Mars. All that's ahead on Intersection. City leaders are working with private investors on a $1.5 million plan to install large, iconic sculptures throughout downtown Orlando. The first sculpture is expected to be in place by this summer. Some will be more than two stories tall. Here to talk about it, I'm joined by Jennifer Quigley. She's chairwoman of Sea Art Orlando, the nonprofit organization behind the effort. Jennifer, nice to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Also with us is Anna Heller. She's director of the Cornell Fine Arts Museum at Rollins College. Anna, great to have you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And we're joined by Orlando Mayor Buddy Dyer. Mayor, great to have you with us.
Thanks so much.
So I'm going to start with you, Mayor Dyer. You've taken a special interest in this project. Why is that?
In 2003, one of the main parts of my platform was revitalizing downtown. And I think we've done a pretty good job at that with high-rise residential, the venues, SunRail coming online, retail. And I was talking with Jennifer a couple of years ago about what else we needed to do in downtown. And she made me realize that great downtowns have great sculpted public art. And we had a little bit, but we didn't have anything like Chicago or Seattle or Portland or Charlotte or Madrid or Barcelona or some of the great downtowns. So told her since she had pointed that out to me, it was her responsibility to help me fix that issue. And we created Sea Art Orlando and put together a number of people that are interested in art in our downtown. And here we go.
Jennifer Quigley, what do you see as the art identity of Orlando? What are you hoping to accomplish with these installations of sculptures?
Well, I think we're a very young, contemporary city, so we challenge the artists to create sculptures that reflect that. I think it's going to really drive tourism and residents to come downtown to see these fabulous pieces of art that we're going to have up, hopefully, early summer.
And Anna Heller, you come from New York City, a place known for great art, certainly an iconic city. What does it take for a community to connect with public art, embrace that as part of a cultural identity?
Well, I think the first step is being taken here with this project because first you have to bring the art into the public sphere. And as a museum professional, I'm really excited and I congratulate you on starting this project because people need to have art not only tucked away in galleries and museums, but also in the public sphere, in on the streets that they walk and in the parks that they gather in. And I think that starts getting people thinking about art in a different way.
Now, what happens if you stop it and you look at it and you go, ugh, man, that is not what I view as a great piece of art. Is that a possibility? You know, you could face rejection with something like
that. That's definitely a possibility, and that's not a bad possibility. I think if people start thinking about art, you know, not everybody likes the same thing. And in our museums, just like on our streets, people are going to say, ah, my five-year-old can do that. And that's, you know, that's not good, but at least it's stopping to look at it and you know, kind of getting it into your visual perception, and then if you can start a dialogue from there and explain that your five-year-old really can't do that and why, I think you've won the battle.
Mayor Dyer, are you prepared if the citizens have some rejection on some of these pieces of art?
I think there's going to be a fairly wide variety of pieces, and not everybody's going to like every piece, but I guarantee you everybody's going to talk about every piece, and so far, I guess we've selected six of the eight pieces, and they're all different. They're all iconic, and the criteria we're using, you just hit right on the head. We want people to stop in their tracks and say, huh, wow, that's kind of cool, and we think that we have pieces that people are going to come downtown just to take their picture with.
And I want to talk to Jennifer Quigley in just a moment about some of the ideas of what these pieces might look like. But let me ask you, Mayor, I mean, you see this every day downtown, the 63-foot Tower of Light, which has been dubbed by some the asparagus when it was installed near City Hall in 1992. That piece faced some criticism as maybe an example of government waste, of $483,000 piece of art there that not everybody embraces. And so it sounds like it could be healthy if you took a bite, but...
Well, again, I think people are going to love the art, but, you know, some people like soldiers on horseback instead of contemporary art, so not everybody's going to like every piece that we have, but I think they're going to talk about it, they're going to enjoy it, and it's going to give an identity to the art scene, but they won't have the criticism of saying we shouldn't have spent public money on it because we're not doing that. We have solicited private donations. There are 8 sponsors, 1 for each of the pieces, and it's a private-public partnership, the public part being we're donating the land and putting some political muscle behind it, but it's private funding that's paying for the pieces.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. We're talking about a new plan to install iconic art sculptures in downtown Orlando. I'm joined by Mayor Buddy Dyer, also Jennifer Quigley of Sea Art Orlando and Anna Heller of the Cornell Fine Arts Museum at Rollins College. I'm Mark Simpson. What kind of art would you like to see in downtown Orlando? Tell us about it, Facebook and Twitter, or send an email to intersection@wmfe.org. Talk to me, Jennifer Quigley, about where these pieces are going to be installed. A lot of them I know are around Lake Eola, but also what's the variety of art that you're looking at?
We have 8 locations, 5 of which are around Lake Eola and 3 of which are on Orange Avenue. We have 8 different sponsors, and so each sponsor has a different eye for what they like. So that helps us make sure that we have variety in the sculptures that are going up. And they're very creative. Some of them are solar-powered. Some of them are copper. Some are stainless steel. You're going to find a little bit, I think, that everyone will like something about at least one piece.
Is there a theme for them?
They just need to be contemporary and reflect the spirit of Orlando.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wonder, what do you think, Anna Heller, just coming to Orlando as you have? You've been in this city for several months. What are your impressions of the vibe that this city gives off? What would you like to see in terms of art?
I have been very pleasantly surprised at how much there is going on in Orlando in terms of arts and culture. And so that's very positive. I think that the vibe that I would like the sculpture to give out is, you know, we are an art city. We can compete, you know, we can play with the big boys. And I think there's you know, a lot of people around the country don't know that necessarily, but I think a project like this can put Orlando on the map in a different way. Other cities have done this recently, and it's really been very, very popular. And also just history teaches us a lot. I think we should all remember, in terms of people who may have negative reactions or not so positive reactions, we have to remember that the Parisians hated the Eiffel Tower when it went up. So, you know,
right.
any of these sculptures may become extraordinarily iconic in 10, 20, or 100 years.
Mayor Dyer, you've had the chance certainly to travel around Florida. Is there a Florida city that's doing art right that you might have looked to for inspiration or example, or even want Orlando to compete with?
You know, I actually can't think of a Florida city. I think we will be the Florida city. And, you know, you talk about notoriety and putting us on the map. I think just the call to artists put us on the map. I'd like Jennifer to talk about the response that we got from Florida, from the United States, from North America, and then all around the world.
We had 187 artists respond within the time frame. There were many more that came in late, from 36 states and 16 countries. So we had a fabulous response to it.
And is there a special chance for local artists to get in on this, or at least Florida artists? Are you leaning in that direction necessarily?
Absolutely. We want to support our local artists, and we have made some tentative selections that include local artists.
Talk to me about the size. When you talk about public art, how big are these pieces going
to
be?
Well, we tried to scale the pieces to the specific site so that it fit its parameters. And they're anywhere from 10 feet tall to 25 feet tall, anywhere from 15 feet wide to 20 feet wide. So they're going to be significant pieces.
And you also had to consider the Florida environment.
Absolutely. We want them to be, they have to meet hurricane code. They have to be built out of materials that require low maintenance, that for our tropical climate that, you know, are not going to fade, they're not going to peel. We don't want anything that's going to be a lot of maintenance. However, I will say that part of the funds we've raised are going into a maintenance account that'll take care of the maintenance for these sculptures over the next 15 years.
We are also making them sustainable. So to the extent there is uplighting, we're working with OUC to make it solar-powered uplighting or solar uplighting, and then several of the likely pieces have solar components built into the piece.
Mayor Dyer, talk to me. How does this fit in with the Buddy Dyer vision for Orlando? Because as you've been in office, you've made it a goal to kind of create a downtown community 24 hours. You've achieved the three venues for downtown Orlando. Now you're tackling on public art. Is this just a piecemeal thing, or is there a grand master plan that Buddy Dyer's rolling out bit by bit here?
No, I would say from the very beginning that when I campaigned in 2003, one of the things I said is that we will be a dominant region, but you can't be a dominant region without a great downtown. Anywhere you go to visit, you go to Chicago, you go to Charlotte, Seattle, Portland, people identify that community with the downtown. We're a little bit different because you can come to Orlando and go to Disney, Universal, SeaWorld without ever
totally
traveling through our downtown. But we're going to change it so that when people come to Orlando, one of the destinations that they want to come to is our downtown. So the overall vision is creating the best downtown in all of America. Secondarily, we want to kick off a decade of art in Orlando. So year one is going to be the placing of kickoff with Sea Art Orlando and these eight iconic pieces. Year two will be the opening of the Performing Arts Center, Dr. Phillips Performing Arts Center. And then we're going to ask Anna to come up with an idea for what year three will be. But we want to focus on art in Orlando and really put Orlando on the map in terms of being an art city destination.
So you tackle art now. Where do you take Orlando next?
Well, the other thing that I'm spending a little bit of time on is the design of the Florida Citrus Bowl. The whole landscape of postseason play and college football is changing. We're going to be bidding to be one of the six sites for the playoffs games or remain in the BCS, and we're going to be looking to bring neutral site games and other events. We have a world-class arena. Well, I would say the best in the world, not just world-class, the best in the world. We're going to have a world-class performing arts center, and we need to raise the standard of the Citrus Bowl. And when we have those three venues, there isn't an event that is hosted in the world that we can host here in Orlando.
Jennifer Quigley, talk to me about when are we going to find out when these artists, who they are, and when do we look for these pieces to start rolling out?
It'll be on our website, which is seaartorlando.com. The artists will have time to create their concepts and give us all the specifications for fabrication, and you will see them going into the ground hopefully by May or June of 2013.
We'll be looking forward to seeing that and getting some visuals. I've been speaking with Jennifer Quigley. She's chairwoman of Sea Art Orlando. We're also joined by Anna Heller. She's director of the Cornell Fine Arts Museum at Rollins College. And, of course, Orlando Mayor Buddy Dyer. Thank you all for coming in to talk about this.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Up next, we get inside the composer's notebook and find out how one musician writes scores for NASA's next generation of space missions. The gap between science and science fiction is moving ever closer together. Today, we're flying missions to beyond the moon, to Mars. Mars, always a favorite topic for sci-fi movies. It also got a turn, though, in a short series of films this summer that look ready for the big screen, and they were musically scored like a bit of a science fiction thriller. Let's listen into a bit of it.
Entry, Descent, and Landing, also known as EDL, is referred to as the 7 minutes of terror, because we've got literally 7 minutes to get from the top of the atmosphere to the surface of Mars, going from 13,000 miles an hour to zero, in perfect sequence, perfect choreography, perfect timing, and the computer has to do it all by itself with no help from the ground. If any one thing doesn't work just right, it's game over.
That's from the film 7 Minutes of Terror. It's an online video that NASA produced, and it went completely viral this summer as the Mars Curiosity rover landed on the red planet after an incredibly complicated maneuver. The rover launched from Florida's Space Coast. John Beck is the man who composed that video's score. He created the video. He's a NASA producer who's put together a half dozen videos on the Curiosity mission and the people behind it. He joins me now from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena to tell the story of how a NASA mission gets put together through music. John Beck, nice to speak with you.
Nice to speak with you.
So you're a producer at NASA's JPL lab, which is managing the Curiosity mission, and you've created a series of videos on this two-year mission, which is aimed at determining whether or not life ever existed on Mars. You work as a composer, but you're also assembling videos, doing production work, camera work. What's a typical day like for you?
Well, for the past 4 months, a typical day has been grab the camera, run down to the mission support area, start shooting their daily activities of waking up the rover and planning out their driving for the day, or their science instruments, or figuring out where they are, and interviewing people. And that's my normal activities today, is just mostly shooting now that we're on Mars. But before we landed, I was shooting them doing testing and then taking that footage and making promotional videos for the project.
Well, when you put together those videos, is it a complete concept from start to finish? Or as you put together these different elements, do you kind of do it on the fly? How does the package come together?
Sometimes there's a vision before I start shooting, and I come back. Like 7 Minutes of Terror definitely had a very specific goal. The thing that popped in my head as soon as they said we need another one, I just kept thinking, you know, I really want to make this one scary and intense. And I kept the music from the Inception trailer kept playing in my head, and so that's what I kind of used as a jumping off point. And I sat down and I interviewed Adam Stelzner immediately the next morning. And I said, you know, I want this to be different. I don't want this to be, you know, a typical explaining how well it's going to work. I want it to actually be more like how we think it might not work, and this is what's scary. So,
well, let's listen to a little bit of some of that music. Okay, so immediately, it gets your attention. It really does. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about what did you want to accomplish with this musical theme that was used in this video depicting the Mars Curiosity rover getting ready to land?
Well, I wanted it to feel as if this was an episode of Mission Impossible, really, where whenever you were watching the TV show or the movies, they would always present this, okay, we have to break into this place, and if we can even get past the door, the front door, which we can't, we have to then get into the next room, which we won't be able to because it's covered with lasers and whatnot. But if we can get through that, then we have to get through this next level, and so on and so on. And that's how the landing felt to me. Every time they'd explain one part, they're like, okay, now that we just figured that out, now we have to do this even more complex part. And so I wanted it to feel like this was impossible. And by the time they cut to the sky crane maneuver, you almost wanted to laugh because it just kept getting more complex.
So did they immediately say, hey, this is the theme we want? You know, NASA's known for kind of having these majestic themes with these great, you know, expansive mm-hmm. thoughts of exploring the universe. Did people immediately sign on to this vision, or did you really have to sell it?
Well, I kind of, how do I explain this? I just got it done really quickly, and then I was like, I don't know if they're going to go for this. I think this is going a little too far, and so I'm like, who do I show it to first? And my coworker, who was also helping me with the graphics, were like, you know, let's just show it to our division manager, and we're like crossing our fingers, and he was like, you know, I'm scared, but I think it's good. So he went for it, and so it kind of trickled down from there.
Well, let's listen just a little bit more. So, John Beck, how long does it take to compose the music for something like this?
It was about a week and a half, really. They really wanted me to wrap it up pretty quickly because we wanted to get this video out there. I'm kind of a, when it comes to music especially, I mean, that's actually my passion when doing these videos. And so trying to get a score that sounds like a real orchestra is really time consuming, and you really gotta get in there and caress it just right. And I'm using, you know, a really great sample library which has sampled each instrument of the orchestra, but I still have to play that on a keyboard, and it's very difficult to make a keyboard sound like a violin, and so you have to really, it's a lot of trial and error.
Now, there's a whole series of videos related to the Curiosity mission, broadly called the Martians, and these films show the imaginings of what the people behind the Curiosity mission are picturing, kind of imagining what it would be like if they traveled to Mars. What would they experience? And there's one particular video called Life at 79 Degrees North, where researchers go and actually visit a spot in Norway where mm-hmm. conditions are similar to those on Mars. And we've got some music from that. Let's listen. I'm smiling because I'm thinking, God, that is a really realistic sounding cello. I mean, I could be convinced on a quick listen that's really what that is, and it's got this really nice arpeggiating theme. What were you going for with this?
Just some kind of a very beautiful sound, going on an adventure, and you know, even though it was, you know, I went on this trip and I shot that footage, and as well as all the footage that you see in The Martians. And, you know, it was just so cold and extreme, but there was something so beautiful about that adventure, and I wanted to capture that in the music and the spirit behind it. And, yeah, I was really happy with that particular piece of music. It had a very hopeful sound, and I ended up reusing it in another Martians episode. About the launch, and at both times it worked really well.
What do you think about, you've got a mix there of, obviously you're going for traditional things with instruments like the cello, but you've got synths mixed right in there, and, you know, I really think, you know, since especially the late 90s with video games like Myst and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. you really see stuff like that, and you hear it now in modern film scores where there's synth elements there with the orchestra. What's your feeling on blending those two? Are you're not a purist, you're doing it, but what are your thoughts on it?
You know, it's there were times when I went through stages of being a purist. I remember in the 90s I was in a band, and by the mid-90s, we were just, like, so opposed to synthesizers. It was like, we just want everything to be real and analog sounding, and because we felt like it was a cheat, because so many people were using it as a cheat. And then I would start to hear artists that were doing something really original with those sounds, like Aphex Twin, and I thought, it was just so interesting, and it took my mind in this environment and made me dream and imagine these places, and anything that can take my imagination somewhere, I'm like, you know what, that's I don't care where that sound came from. And I would hear other artists like John Powell and Harry Gregson Williams, Thomas Newman, even use synthesizers with the orchestra, and it sounded so fresh that it didn't bother me to mix the two together.
So your job at NASA is involved with public engagement, and these videos around the Curiosity mission really took off. They became a viral sensation on the internet and, in a large sense, helped make NASA cool again in the wake of the space shuttle retiring and, you know, a bit of turmoil in the space agency. But what do you think this NASA needs to do to really kind of recapture the public interest that it had back in those glory days?
Oh, man. Strongly, I feel, and, you know, sometimes I feel like I'm going out on a limb with this, and it's risky to say this, but it is a risky business space. And in the glory days, it was just so much risk involved, and we knew we were taking risks, and we knew we could die doing this. And those original seven astronauts knew they could die doing this. And the Apollo mission was dangerous, and we embraced it, and we went for it. And that's what makes it so exciting, is when we know it's like, you know what, we could die. We could totally die, and it's worth it. And I feel like, you know, that kind of trying to be too safety, and we had those accidents that were shocking and just grieving, you know, as a nation to see, you know, when we lost two shuttles. It's terrible. I remember just how horrible I felt when after the Columbia disaster. And man, you know, the rest of the world is like, I really feel like is just, there's a lot of different agencies, private agencies that are dying to go to Mars, and they're willing to take those risks and maybe even not come home, to go to Mars one way, and we're going to live out the rest of our days there just to go. And that's the kind of spirit we need to re-embrace, is that, you know what, in 200, 300 years ago, when people were exploring, going to the farthest reaches of our planet, they knew they might not come home. And we need to be able to re-embrace that. And I think 7 Minutes of Terror kind of touched on that risk, is we might not make it, but this is what we're trying to do. We kind of think maybe we're a little crazy too, but we think we can do this. And man, I think that's what made it so exciting on landing day. It was like, because there were so many people who were like, that's never going to work. And when it did, it was like, oh my gosh, it worked. So.
Well, John Beck, give us an update. What's the latest with the Curiosity mission?
Well, we're right now searching for a spot to do our first drilling into the rock. So it's actually kind of a dangerous thing to do. Believe it or not, it sounds so simple, but there's so many things that could go wrong trying to drill into a rock. So we're searching for that right spot, the right rock to drill into, and yeah. Hopefully that'll happen in the next couple weeks.
We've been speaking with John Beck. He is the composer behind the music for 7 Minutes of Terror and a lot of the mission videos that are with the Curiosity Mars mission. He's a composer and a NASA producer, speaking to us from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. John Beck, so nice to speak with you.
It's great to speak with you.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at WMFE.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.